So I've come out to my coworkers as somebody who runs a Star Trek podcast and may or may not be a Trekkie.
I'm proud of you.
I know. So
that takes a lot of courage.
So one of them we were talking about, because we used to watch Reading Rainbow as a kid, and we both remembered the episode where, like, he took, you know, LeVar Burton, like, showed the set and some of the behind-the-scenes stuff.
Oh, sure.
We both specifically remembered the part where they did the transporter by stirring the water. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course I do.
And then another guy has spoiled basically the entirety of the franchise because, for me, and yet he's done so in such an incoherent way that I have no context for anything and I don't understand any of it.
What did he tell you?
I don't know, like, nothing that I really didn't know already. Like, he said, oh, the Cardassians in Deep Space Nine, and I know they're in Deep Space Nine and stuff. I don't really know what, yeah, like, he mentioned a couple characters that, whose names I don't remember or who I haven't, like, really heard, uh-huh, or, you know, so it, you know, it was all meaningless, but.
So, basically, what you're telling me is your coworker is an incompetent jerk.
I mean, he's fun.
Okay. Did he tell you anything about schisms?
No, but I could tell you a lot about schisms in that it was badass.
No, it's really good. I like this one.
This is one of the scarier episodes. Like, this is a good episode.
I don't know. Well, I guess seeing it, I mean, I've seen it before, yeah, so I wasn't scared. I guess I could see it being scary.
Yeah.
And this is something that Brannon Braga does very well.
This is a Braga
this
episode.
This is a very Braga
yeah,
episode.
Yeah, I didn't notice who wrote it, but it hit all his beats.
Yeah, yeah. He writes this kind of thing very well. And what I like about it is that it's the actual sort of like alien abduction stuff is not important.
Yeah, it's irrelevant. It's, I mean, the fact that they end the episode where we don't really understand what happened, you know, we have some theories, here's what we know, but we don't know if this is going to happen again or what. Like, that kind of adds to the, I'm going to assume that they never, you know, these don't become a recurring antagonist in the series. I assume.
Well, actually, your coworker probably told you that the alien fish people became the primary antagonist in Deep Space Nine.
Ah.
He was lying.
Okay.
No, they don't come back.
Yeah, you know, but they do also leave it for they could come back. There is the possibility of one of the movies is them dealing with them again, you know, like that kind of a thing. You can imagine that. I mean, I'm fairly sure that someone's written a novel about them coming back in the final battle and all of that.
Probably. I don't know.
But we're left with them as this just kind of, I mean, we don't get that much more than glimpses of them. You know, we see, yes, they look like fish people, and yes, maybe the makeup is a little bit underwhelming, but at the same time, we know nothing about them, and that's kind of creepy. This is not a mystery that they solve. This is something that they kind of figure out and get out of, but with so much left unanswered.
Yeah, and only really for a very, very, you know, brief amount of time, too.
Yeah.
Because, of course, you know, the ending is I think the episode really takes a different turn when suddenly everyone is like, what the hell's going on? And you've got that scene in the holodeck,
yeah,
with the table, and then suddenly it becomes this very strange sort of like riff on the sort of like big-eyed alien abduction stuff that
yeah,
was popular,
yeah, yeah,
you know, in the 90s. Which, I don't know where that stuff went, incidentally.
Huh.
I used to really like that stuff when I was a teenager, and you don't really hear about it anymore.
I was
going anyway.
To say, I just think, you know, there was, I mean, it was one of those cultural things. You know, you had a ton of big series like The X-Files dealing with it. You have tons of movies, and
I remember that was a big staple of Unsolved Mysteries.
Yeah, like right now, everyone makes stuff about zombies. In 10 years, we're probably not going to be seeing zombies as much. You know, like,
yeah,
it's just one of those cyclical, you get there's a monster or something interesting, which, you know, hits a, I mean, let's also talk about where the in the 90s was when, you know, a lot of people were having more fear of technology.
Yeah.
And, you know, these new technologies coming in and going to disrupt, and that's what UFOs represent. Zombies is fear of the anonymous mob.
Yeah.
Which is a more modern fear than that was.
Right. And so I guess you could interpret the alien abduction stuff as being some sort of fear of technology in a way.
Yeah.
Or fear of advancement or fear, mm-hmm, of the unknown or whatever,
yeah, yeah,
you want,
yeah,
to call it. But yeah, this is Star Trek: The Next Generation, you know, riffing on that kind thing in the zeitgeist, if you want to use that term. I don't like it, but I used it anyway.
But I mean, it's a way for Star Trek to do that, because normally, I mean, let's face it, the traditional alien abduction story has a very large disparity in technology. In other words, it's like us now,
right,
versus a spacefaring civilization, you know. But, you know, Star Trek is, you know, if you think of a traditional, you know, gray alien or anything that they faced in the X-Files, you know, Star Trek is at or past that level of technology. So normally, like, the aliens, you know, you don't think about, well, they're going to be abducted and, you know, experimented on and all of that, because that's just not the way that Starfleet works. It seems, you know, this is a military spacefaring vessel.
It's not really the way that the universe works.
Yeah, exactly. And this is a way for, by having it, this weird interdimensional being that's, you know, it's a way to get that kind of a story into a universe that normally does. And the fact that it does it fairly well.
Yeah, because I think if this was a straight up abduction, you know, scenario where these aliens existed in their own plane of reality, the same as Starfleet, the same as our show, I think that would have been a bit much. And I think that, you know, there's a way to tell that story that would have made sense and would have been contained and wouldn't have led to some sort of war, but it would have been difficult. And so, and also, frankly, I think that there's a level of, hubris involved as well, because of course the reason why the aliens discovered them in the first place is that Geordi was kind of fucking around with the something or other alien, you know, the power conduits and sensor array, and decided to do something, and then this happened.
I mean, to riff on that, I mean, this is just clicking my head. He even jokingly calls it the Geordi array or something like that. You know, he's joking, but at the same time, I mean, yeah, it's, you know, if that's a symbol of hubris, then that's a very kind of almost on the nose but effective way of doing that. I mean, this is reminding me of way back in Encounter at Farpoint with Q saying to them, you know, you're about to go further into space and you're going to see some shit. You know, this is them angling into another, you know, maybe it's not distance wise further, but they are going into places that they aren't necessarily supposed to go and aren't really ready to go.
Yeah, well, I was about to, I'm glad you said that, because I was about to say that, you know, The Next Generation, you know, for all of its strengths, hasn't really lived up to the promise of Encounter at Farpoint, I think, in some ways, because it just became a different show. And
and in a way, the Borg were kind of, again, I interpret that as prefiguring the Borg. Whether they were whether that was intended or not at the time, they are kind of that they can legitimately face go as an incomprehensible threat that they've never faced before.
I think the thing about leaving things vague like that is that you can kind of retcon anything into it. You know, of course they didn't have the Borg on their mind when they were writing Encounter or Farpoint, but the Borg fits in fine.
Yeah, they're even big enough and exciting enough that it's satisfying enough.
Right, and they were even able to fit in Q. You know, Q, you could even make the argument that Q had the Borg in mind in Encounter at Farpoint.
Who
knows? I mean, probably not, but you could certainly make that argument. And so, what I like about this episode is that it does kind of, you know, at least for this one episode, it paints the galaxy and it paints the universe and it paints sort of the picture of the show as a little more dangerous, a little more unknown.
Yeah.
You know, these are very, very different aliens from what we've seen before. They're creepy. We don't know what their motivations are.
Yeah.
They even speculate openly about whether or not they're explorers, kind of thing, these things. And at the end of the day, we're not left with any answers. They have no answers.
Yeah.
And, you know, Riker and Ensign Rager kind of escaped by the skin of their teeth. And so we're not used to seeing, especially Riker in that situation, someone who's very, very competent, who's very, you know, sort of energetic, and someone who's very put together. And seeing him in that situation, I think, you know, sort of makes the fear of it even more abstract in a way.
It's interesting how this begins, because this – I don't know. We've talked, you know, ever so often. I think last week we mentioned that, you know, I think I said, like, this episode feels like, you know, a rehash of several other episodes. I can't remember which one I was talking about that with. But I know I've said that about a few episodes. And in a way, this is the kind of the episode earlier on where nobody was getting any REM sleep. Remember that one?
Right. Oh,
I mean, this does come from an element of a few things, but – I liked this episode a lot. Because
and Picard's Aunt Adele's
yes.
hot milk again makes an appearance.
And I'm thinking, you know, again, I didn't.
I'm kind of thinking that maybe like, because I think Picard gave Beverly the recipe, and then Beverly gave Riker the recipe.
Oh my God! There's like this. The toddy is going to like go through from like person to person. I didn't know this was a Braga episode when I watched it, but the scene with the table and where it's slowly like step by step becoming more and more threatening. Again, that was the most effective scene. It's a very horrifying scene because it's, again, every little bit just reveals, no, it wasn't like that. It was worse. No, it wasn't like that. It was worse. No, it wasn't like that. We had these horrible clicking sounds. No, they were higher pitched. No, they were fat. Like, that yeah. was a really... But that reminded me of the scene with Geordi in the hollow, you know, when he was trying to... Yeah. And...
Well, Braga likes writing yes. things like that, obviously.
And he does hit the... I didn't like the Geordi scene when I saw it, just largely because I wasn't quite sure what his endgame was or what exactly he was doing. And that episode, I never quite did understand what the boogeyman of the episode was. Here, it was very obvious what they were doing and these people trying to recreate this memory and they're slowly shifting it to... I could see that it was going – I guess I could, the end point felt a lot clearer for me. And, you know, this episode has a lot of set pieces like that which work.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, this episode gels in a way that Identity Crisis, I believe that episode yes. was, never really did gel.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, whether or not that's because Brennan Braga has gotten better at writing these characters and better at writing in general, I don't know. You could speculate. But I think that, you know, there's a very – when he has a very strong idea, I think the problem with Identity Crisis was just that it was kind of a generic body horror episode.
Yeah.
And he didn't really have a point. Whereas this one is very much, you know, again, like we said, a riff on the alien abduction stuff that was happening in the culture. And, you know, even down to, you know, a counselor, Troy, kind of like counseling them all and
yeah.
sort of like hidden memories and forgotten memories and these kinds of things. You know, this is all very, very much like that kind of stuff. And so I think when he has something to hang it on, you know, and has a point and has a through line,
yeah.
I think he's a very effective writer.
I mean, I know when it was revealed that, oh, people are, you know, like, again, I still never really quite figured out what was happening to Geordi or what these creatures were or what. And the episode kind of thought that it explained all of that. And so I was left with a lot
with Identity Crisis,
yeah.
I mean, yeah.
And I was left with a very vague sense. Here, you get the sense that they know a lot. I'm sure Braga had more of an idea of what the alien's purpose was and left parts out particularly to. And that sense of an answeredness, again, adds to the unease of it. I mean, this
yeah.
is – Identity Crisis was supposed to end on kind of a poignant but, you know, otherwise resolved note. Here, it is a massive unresolved thing. I mean, these people – and let's face it. This is an episode where – this is a series where they dealt with Picard's trauma after the Borg. Here, we're left with a horrible thing happened to these people.
Yeah, well, and I also think, frankly, that you know, the motivations of the aliens in this episode
yeah.
are unexplained, but I don't think that they're that hard to
yeah.
figure out. And what I like about the episode and what I think is interesting about it is that none of the characters, they're all very smart, and
yeah.
you know that they know why the aliens are doing
yeah.
this, but they can't quite bring themselves to accept it. They don't really they don't really want to believe that aliens would do this to them.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, this is a series that has always left us with the message that we can ultimately resolve our differences. You know, if they're let's face it, the crystalline entity, before that doctor destroys it, it's starting to communicate with them.
Right.
Like that episode is a tragedy because they had the opportunity to make this entity understand what it was doing and to work together and to have this accord. Like, again, and, you know, just human frailty ruined that. But here the aliens are treating them almost like lab rats. I mean, in a way, it's not.
I mean, literally.
Yeah, yeah, literally. And so you don't see the aliens. I don't see these aliens giving a shit, you know, about trying to communicate. You know, any attempts from the Federation will just be utterly ignored as noise. You know, they may – hell, you know, I think the more the Federation would try to talk to them, the more they would figure out how to sever vocal cords without, you know, doing any further damage just to shut them up, you know.
Well, I think, you know, yeah, I think there's something to that. But yeah. I also think that, you know – you know, we don't know, right?
Well,
and
that's
so
it.
I think, you know, speculating on what exactly the aliens are doing is really not the point of the episode.
You said that, you know, nobody's really willing to finally, you know, go and make that final statement of, well, here's what we're doing. I mean, they say at the end, well, they could be explorers. They could just be looking for a way to explore this place safely. But then they point out, yeah, but, you know, they did it in a very brutal way, which very literally showed no regard for it. I don't know. It shows, like, Riker and everybody desperately trying to give them the benefit of the doubt.
Oh, absolutely.
Even when they know that, you know, at the, you know, in the middle of the night, Riker is not going to be thinking, how do I, you know, but shit, there's a race that's, you know, willing to just butcher us in order to figure out how to go. And
right.
What is it going to do? Is it trying to take over? Is it, you know, like that's what his night thoughts are going to be. And the day in the conference room, they're almost desperately clinging to the Federation's ideals of peace and of cooperation. Well, and
yeah, that's the thing. And I think that's, you know, that's why I want to kind of read this in a more abstract level, because
yeah.
I think that, you know, we've talked before about how Star Trek believes in good, but doesn't believe in the existence of evil, mm-hmm. right? Like, there is no evil. Everyone is redeemable, and every sort of alien species is redeemable, and everything is redeemable to some degree.
Yeah.
And I think that this is kind of another example of that, where
The Borg are redeemable.
Even the Borg are, yeah, with I-Borg, exactly. And so, you know, this episode is kind of going very up close to that line and saying, yeah. Well, here are some aliens that are, you know, doing terrible things. I mean, you know, they cut off Riker's arm.
That part was,
that's like, whoa, what the hell? You know,
what they do to the one guy, they say his blood's been replaced with a polymer.
Yeah,
like,
it's like turning into a polymer.
That's horrible.
Yeah, like, why
die.
Would they even do that? I don't know. So they're obviously, like, getting more advanced in their experiments, right? And sort of just doing things to do things. And there's a certain level of sort of, like, you know, Nazi experiments on patients or whatever. Well, not patients, prisoners. I am not a Nazi or a Nazi sympathizer. But, you know, to a certain degree, I think that, again, it doesn't matter, but it matters to the degree that their reaction matters, to the Enterprise crew's reaction matters. And I think that I don't know. It's hard to say whether or not they really are uncomfortable with the idea, or if they're deluding themselves, or if they really do believe that everything is redeemable to some degree. And I don't know what the answer is.
I mean,
I think that this is kind of the closest example yet, maybe outside of conspiracy with the aliens that are bursting and taking control of people. That was also a very tonally off episode of the show at that point, that maybe they're making another argument like that. I don't know.
Like, I get this series very much is aware of the fact that principles are different in theory than in practice. I mean, I think this is – and it also is aware of the fact that recognizing that contradiction is important, but it's also never easy to deal with. And
sure.
So I think we have them – all of these people believe in the goodness of the soul and believe in the, you know, dignity of every living thing and all of that. And,
right.
You know, they recognize that this needs to be – you know, whatever, you know, the dignity of the living means does need to be revised every so often. They've met even, you know, Data is a regular reminder of that fact.
Yeah.
And yet I think they all know that while that's right and that's what they believe in, they also know it's hard. And they also know that they have an enemy right now in this episode, which does not believe in the dignity of everything, and which does not believe that. I mean, this might even be just a cancerous entity. These fish people—they may just solely exist to destroy and consume. We don't know.
Don't we all exist just to destroy and consume?
Well, that's.
I mean, you know, I'm not trying to be glib.
No, I know what you mean. I guess the point that I'm leading to here is that they have to deal with the fact that here is somebody who's just not ascribed to these beliefs in any way, and they have to re-examine their own beliefs to how they feel about that. You think that Riker doesn't, you know, if Riker could snap his fingers and get rid of, you know, kill all of these fish people immediately. You think he wouldn't?
I don't think he would.
Well, it's a very hard thing for him to not want to.
I mean, I'm sure he probably would want to. He wouldn't be comfortable that he wanted to.
Yeah.
But I also don't think he would do it. Yeah. You know, but I'm also reminded of, you know, I don't know. It's hard. I don't really want to talk about this yet because I think that we can talk a lot about this sort of thing when we get to Deep Space Nine.
Okay.
And
maybe
I think I'll just leave it there because, you know, we also have to remember that these fish aliens, whoever they are, you know, they're only a group of five or six individuals.
That's true.
We don't know who they are. We don't know what their operating structure is. We don't know if they're rogue agents.
You mentioned Nazis. Is it possible to judge the entire human race by, you know, a group of people?
Right, exactly. I mean, you know, let's look a crazy thought experiment of some sort of, you know, subspace aliens from another dimension happened upon, you know, Mengele. Would they have thought that humanity was irredeemable? I don't know. They may have. So in that sense, I think that it's a little thing about Brown and Braga episodes is that I think that they allow us to sort of extrapolate out from one event,
yes,
but you kind of have to stop yourself from doing that.
Well, I was about to say, this is making me go in two directions. Number one, let's go back to the fact of Encounter at 4 Point is very literally a group of aliens taking a group of people and deciding whether or not the human race is redeemable or not. In the case of Picard, it turns out the answer is yes, but at the same time, that's a very it's a very human thing to do, to take a small sample and extrapolate that into a worldview and a judgment.
I mean, that's what humans do.
Yeah.
Though. I mean, that we're pattern recognition machines.
Yeah.
In a way. I mean, that's what we're the best at.
Well, I think it's funny that this is, again, we've seen Next Generation anticipating a lot of things, but maybe episodes like that are kind of showing the limitations of the anthology series. You know, this episode is evoking some fairly complex questions.
Yeah.
About the series and about, you know, what we can extrapolate about the series philosophy and all of that kind of stuff. And yes, a show like Next Generation, it is very possible to talk about the show's philosophy because there were very explicit philosophies used to create the show. And yet I think we're hitting up against the limitations of this series to properly address them, and yet the desire to. I mean, it's very natural that these are the kinds of questions that this kind of a show would start to ask.
I think that's right.
And so I think, I still have not seen any DS9, but from what you're telling me, it almost seems like that's Star Trek's way of creating a show that can support some of the more weighty questions.
I think so. And I think that TNG is a certain type of show.
Yeah.
It asks a lot of questions that perhaps it's not equipped or sort of built to answer. And Deep Space Nine is the show that kind of, I think, maybe takes Star Trek, I don't want to say as far as it can go, but certainly as far as 90s television would allow it to go.
And maybe as far as it has gone is another implication I get.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
But I think that's very interesting because, again, that's I don't know. It's weird that, like, I'm finding this as an opportunity to kind of talk more generally about the franchise, you know, and this is a one-off of Brandon Braga horror episode. Well,
if there's one thing that we can do, it's talk a lot about one-off tossed off episodes.
No, I don't know. I see this. I like that. This is one of the reasons I'm thinking that people do love Star Trek at its peak, though, because there's always been a classiness ascribed to Star Trek in a way. And I guess it's the fact that it does attempt to ask deeper questions. And, you know, this is, and we'll see this in the next episode, but this series is about morality.
Yeah.
And I mean, and that's obvious, but it's not obvious for a big sci-fi show to be dealing with that kind of a thing in a way.
I think it's very rare.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's actually funny. I mean, this is kind of an aside, but I've been reading the first volume of These Are the Voyages, which is a very detailed background production history of the original series. And, you know, there were four big science fiction television shows on at the time that Star Trek was on. It was Star Trek, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, Lost in Space, and Time Tunnel. So,
yeah,
you can kind of see. I mean, even back when Star Trek was brand new, it was trying to do something different, adult, mature, than what science fiction had traditionally been on television. And I think you even see that now. I think it's still it's more common for science fiction television now to ask big questions and be very adult, but. You know, you still get things like Stargate SG-1. As much as I like Stargate SG-1, it is not a show that asks hard questions or is really about anything.
It was more just – now, I don't want to say just entertainment because I don't want to imply that that's a
bad
lesser thing or that Star Trek has not had entertainment as the primary purpose. I mean, even on bad episodes, you can tell they at least wanted to try to entertain people. You know, it's not like, oh, we're philosophical and boring, you know, in a way.
Right.
And, but
yeah. And to a certain degree, I think that's why I like popular entertainment more than sort of like high art, because frankly, it's fun to watch, but it also does, when it's done well and has sort of a purpose behind it, like Star Trek often does, you know, allows you to sort of like ask these big questions about what it means to be human and all these kind of things. And the fact that we can kind of talk about this in a weird episode like Schisms, I think, is an example of sort of the relevance of this experiment in a way.
Then my question is, what the hell happened? And I guess we're going to spend the next 4 or 5 years figuring out that answer.
Yeah, probably. I guess we should mention, we haven't talked at all about the beginning of the episode.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a very tonally different from the rest of the episode.
Yes, I was going to say, I'm having trouble like almost fitting it in a way, but...
Well, part of it is that they had the idea for Data to write poetry for a while, and they just sort of fit it into this episode. They don't go back to it in this episode, which is kind of unfortunate in a way.
But where could they do it?
Where could they do it, exactly?
I love where they... I mean, where they end the episode is so eerie and, you know, unfinished that you can't just end with a laugh. You know, oh, Data's going to write a new poem about this incident. You know, like that.
Yeah.
Riker got kidnapped today, and I don't know.
And he sent a Mayday.
You're a terrible poet.
So is Data.
I loved Data's poetry quite unironically. I found them extraordinarily poignant.
I also like Data's poetry a quite deal. I don't like poetry as a general rule. I'm not proud of that necessarily, but poetry just doesn't do anything for me.
Well, I'm similar. But these are like in just that, like, I mean, as the scene itself is a hilarious scene. It's a very well written and very well different. It's a funny scene. It's
Riker's falling asleep. And Star Trek, Troy's, you know, hitting him and all that stuff.
Star Trek doesn't always do comedy, but this is a good Star Trek comedy. I mean, it's clever in that like little kid Shel Silverstein type of here's funny rhymes and stuff like that. But there's an intense, I don't know. It was, you know, Geordi says, oh, I took no emotions from this. But the poems are all about Data interpreting the world as scientific phenomena.
Yeah.
And yet about how that does not take any meaning away from it for him. In other words, the poem about his cat is literally talking about, you know, the taxonomic, you know, qualifications and, you know, what it's like on a biological level. And yet it's ending with him saying, you know, but even though he's still my friend, you know.
Right. And
I think it's a very interesting insight into how Data sees the world, because we've always, you know, does Data have emotions or not? Does Data love or not? And these almost imply to me that Data finds beauty or meaning or love in certain – he's always scanning. Anytime he sees anything, he's thinking about the taxonomic whatever of it. But when he thinks about that with his cat, it gives him a sense of pleasure. And I think that's very – that means – that – I don't know. That was really fucking touching to me.
Well, yeah. No, I like that interpretation of it, and I think that – certainly it is true that that Data is thinking in that way.
Yeah.
But I also think that, you know, if you think back to, like, In Theory, where he had a girlfriend, and she doesn't like the fact that he's thinking about many things at once.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter is, Data is not a person. He's not human. And so to say that he is thinking about things in a certain sort of scientific way is not to discount the possibility that he is also thinking about them in an artistic way, in a beautiful way. You know, he can think about, you know, so many different things at once. You know, the fact that he's trying to channel this into poetry, while the poetry is kind of terrible,
and it's doggerel, let's be honest.
Well, yeah, I mean, Data, I don't think that Data has an aesthetic bone in his body, but that's not to say that he's not a good artist.
Well, I mean, there's also it's interesting you mentioned the girlfriend, because, I mean, the first poem that he reads is pretty much a romantic sunset, and, you know, who the person he's with is bored by the fact that he's talking about. Again, there's a loneliness there, because Data does not have somebody that he can – who gets it. You know, Data looks at a sunset and he sees this. And even though it's just about the light emissions and where the molecules are, again, he finds that beautiful. And yet no one around him can find it beautiful in the way that he does.
True. But you know, I think there, you know, the other thing about Data's poetry is all of that. But also that I kind of got the impression that it's very – it's very childlike. In some ways.
Like I said, you know, it sounds like a kid poem.
Yeah, he's very unselfconscious. Mm-hmm. There is a loneliness to being a kid, which I think is sort of forgotten as you get older. Sort of is not appreciated.
Yeah.
So in those senses, I think that Data is kind of child. I wouldn't say childish or childlike. He doesn't have
innocent qualities.
He's
an innocent in the sense of almost like a Rousseau state of nature way. I mean, and he's been uncorrupted. He is naive. As much as he knows, as much as he has in previous episodes been prepared to kill, he is still an innocent.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. And I think that that's nice. And I think that, you know, having him be in the episode very briefly and only to sort of give his poetry and then get abducted briefly is, I think that kind of makes it more unsettling in a way as well.
I wonder what the hell they thought. They got Data, by the way.
I don't know what they
I completely forgot that they did abduct him at one point.
Yeah. I will give Schisms 7 scissors.
Oh, it got 8 blades from me.
Okay. Also, how scary is it, by the way, that Worf was one of the people that was, like, kidnapped, and it was just yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to True Q. So I both really like and really don't like this episode.
I really liked it. I didn't expect to. The second I thought it was a Q episode, I got, oh, fuck a Q episode. Because I think my coworker loves Q, by the way.
Well, he's stupid, as well as being mean.
I was not ready to settle in for a Q episode. And I liked this. I liked the way they used Q in this episode.
It's not really a Q episode.
That's it. I think that was a lot of it.
Why I like it. And frankly, there's a degree to which I am surprised at how much I am disliking Q on this rewatch.
Yeah.
I don't really watch Q episodes that often, but having them here and watching them and sort of looking at them from a very critical eye, he is a character that I despise.
Yeah.
They are enamored with his sort of humorous possibilities. And frankly, I don't find him charming. I don't find him funny. I don't find him threatening. I just find him annoying and self-aggrandizing.
Yeah.
And there's no interest there, because every single time he appears, it's everyone has the same reaction to him. He never changes. Their reactions never change. And I just feel like I'm watching the same interactions between Picard and Q and Beverly over and over again, even though it's been 6 years now.
Yeah. And in this episode, they go through that very quickly. You get maybe like 2 minutes of, you know, Picard and Q, and then they're like, all right, we just got to work together on this one. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah,
you know, Crusher and Q spend a few more scenes together, but their antagonism is not the focus of it. For once, it's actually they're actually fighting with Q over what they're fighting about. And that remains yeah. the focus of the scene. You know what I mean? Like, it's, they are literally, these are two battling philosophies for the soul of this girl. And I think they, you know, we're not just supposed to be sitting there and laughing at Q and whoever bantering. Like, it is supposed to be these two kind of battling against each other. And I think it worked.
I mean, in a sense it works, and in a sense it doesn't work. You know, I like Amanda. I think that she's a pretty good character. She's sketched out as much as he needs to be sketched out. You know, the actress who plays her is very good, and she's got a lot of range. She likes puppies, which is great.
I want to say, having the power to create puppies out of thin air and then put them back when I'm done with them.
Where did they go? Where did she get them, and where did they go? That's what
it's
I
like
know.
A replicator.
I don't know about that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I don't know.
I don't like that.
The point is, there is like a, there we can imagine another show, which is like two elderly women who run like a puppy orphanage, and like, it's, you know, their little adventures every week. In 1 week, like, all the puppies disappear for like 10 minutes. And then they reappear, and that's it.
And what I guess the thing that is really kind of disturbing about this episode, and it's the reason why I think the reason why I like it is, I don't know, we need to talk about the Q, and we need to talk about the Q continuum, because it's a problem.
They retcon it in this episode in a way I like. I'm going to be honest.
How do they do that?
Because nobody's known what the fucking Q are. Like, nobody, it's never been clear whether it's one being in many avatars, whether it's many beings, what exactly they are. Here they say, well, the Q is a race of, you know, omnipotent beings. Good. All right. That's all I was asking. I could put my head around that. It's essentially a bunch of people who have magic powers. Okay. I'm good with that. That's all I needed to know in this episode. That's all that had factored into this episode. I wasn't really interested in the question to begin with, and the fact that they resolved it so simply is okay with me.
Well, I think that it's, I disagree with you, and I disagree with you for this reason.
Okay.
It's mostly because Q is an artifact. Again, you know, we talked about Encounter at Farpoint while we talked about schisms, and you know, Q is an artifact of an earlier version of the show.
Yeah.
A version of the show which was very much in the original series vein. And what the original series really liked doing a lot was godlike beings. Okay. Q does not fit into this version of the show. Hmm. And so the way that they got him to fit into this version of the show was to turn him from, you know, a trickster god who, frankly, was a little bit creepy, into a joke, in a sense.
Yeah.
And yeah, he could kill them all, and yeah, he could do a lot of terrible things and blah, 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 but he doesn't because he's Q, and then we're just having a light comedy episode, and he's going to take them to Sherwood Forest or whatever.
But that's...
And so, you know, my problem really with it is that they really should just have left well enough alone. I think that there's a lot of really interesting questions that they raise, but there's no way to get out of this omnipotence thing. Picard sort of questions it in this episode a little bit, where he says, well, you're nearly omnipotent. I don't know. But the thing is, you have let's take it at face value, because Star Trek is a show which makes us take things at face value. This is a race of omnipotent, godlike beings who have unlimited power, can do whatever they want, but they obviously have some sort of governing structure, and they obviously have some sort of society, and they can execute their own people. Well, how is that even possible?
Here's the thing. As you said, the original series loved godlike beings, and he was a relic of, you know, oh, here's another godlike being. But I think at this point of the series, of the franchise, it almost seems like they've realized, we've got a bunch of godlike beings running around here. Like, omnipotent power is not that unusual in the Star Trek universe. And so, in a way, it almost kind of gets read in this situation as a hell of a lot of power. And that can almost be enough. And I guess in the sense that what Q uses it for in this episode, he explicitly says, oh, you can do whatever you want. he comes off more in this episode like a spoiled child with magic powers than a god right now.
Well, he's always come across that way.
Yeah, I think this episode is acknowledging that, you know, if he is an omnipotent being, it's not like he's doing anything with it. And I think this episode is very critical of the way Q has always been, because this episode ends with – Amanda is her name?
Yeah.
This episode with – they talk about, you know, was she a Q human hybrid? And to a degree, she is. If she is physically Q and philosophically human, she is using the Q powers to better the world here. You get the sense that what is she going to do? She might just become a space superheroine in a way.
Well, sure. Yeah, that's fine. And I agree with you. I mean, the end of the episode, she stops the machine from blowing up, and she also fixes the planet.
Yeah.
Okay, great. She's a female Captain Planet.
I'm great.
But, you know, my problem with it is that, again, I don't know how much we're supposed to sort of collapse Q into the entire Q continuum, or how much, like, are there differences in the Q? How many Q are there? What are they doing? Why is she, like, I don't know. These are, I know that we're not supposed to get hung up on these sort of questions, you know, but I find it problematic.
You know what this is, you know, and I guess when she said, oh, I'm going to live as a human, I'm not going to use my powers. This episode, to a degree, reminded me a little of Bewitched, which is funny because Mark Twain was Gladys Kravitz the other week. But, I mean, in a way, the Q are basically the witches in Bewitched right now. There is really no functional difference in what they can do. And so...
I mean, I don't know that... What was her name?
Samantha Stevens.
I don't know that Samantha Stevens could have, like, fixed the ozone layer.
No, it's true that they... You know, possibly the, you know, yes, the Q's powers are greater, but they're to the same effect. I guess it's what the show has done with it. What has Q done that's been like a god? He's just done whatever his winds are.
He moved a moon.
He's done whatever
he changed the gravitational constant of the universe.
So he's really powerful. Okay, but I guess I'm not really sure with what your problem is. What is the problem with there being a ton of omnipotent beings in the universe?
I guess I just have a real conceptual problem with it. I don't know how to explain it to you. It's just it bothers me that there's this sort of group of omnipotent beings out there that obviously have some sort of governing structure in some sort of society. How do omnipotent beings execute each other?
Tornadoes, obviously, this episode said it.
How is that possible? Like, yes, they're in human, like, her parents were in human form. And okay, this episode seems to imply that when they're in human form, they have all of the attendant biological abilities that humans do. And what I mean by that is they can fucking get pregnant, but and they can give birth to a human who is actually the powers of the Q. I'm all fine with that.
She's not though.
Human is not. Yeah, well, exactly. Human. You know, Star Trek is not hard sci-fi. I don't need an explanation for how biological imperative of the Q works or how all their powers work or whatever. I don't care about that. But my issue with it is, again, how do they execute?
Maybe they're not really omnipotent. Maybe they just really are really, 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 really fucking powerful.
Okay, that's fine. I would agree with that.
I think
it's obvious that they're not omnipotent.
Yeah, and so I think,
or at least maybe they're nearly omnipotent, but they're certainly not omniscient.
Yeah, but who calls him? Who says the Q are omnipotent? It's always Q himself who's saying that. Who we have agreed is very self-aggrandizing. Who has a very good
opinion. So it's marketing.
I think so. Like, I honestly think, you know.
Okay.
What I think Q comes down, he comes down to people who aren't quite as advanced as him. He says, I'm omnipotent. And most of the time, I mean, really, we're seeing Picard. Part of the reason he's so interested in Picard is because Picard's probably the first one to not take his ship. I mean, you put Q on any other ship that he's been on, you put him in front of any other human, they're going to be terrified of him. Q, you know, Picard doesn't have the patience.
I don't know that I agree with that. No one on the ship is terrified of Q.
Fair point.
Now, you could make an argument that they're taking their lead from Picard. But...
And I could also make the argument that maybe, you know, somebody today versus some, you know, Picard in the 24th, you know, maybe also, that's a thing.
And also, frankly, Richard, I
don't know. We're trying to...
Q appears in other... of the series.
Okay.
And no one's ever afraid of him.
Well, because at this point, what is he really? He's just...
My favorite Q moment happens in Deep Space Nine.
Okay.
And Q is in Deep Space Nine for one episode, and he never appears again.
Oh, good.
Because, well, we can talk about that when we get to it. But suffice it to say, Q does not work in Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Q works in Voyager because Voyager is essentially the next generation.
I don't know to what degree, like, this is us avoiding talking about the episode. Like, I feel like we're getting... But I guess this is the Q question. And maybe I'm just accepting it as, you know, okay, they're super beings. Well, you know, fine.
I don't think that we're getting away from talking about the episode. I think that the episode raises these questions. You know, this is an episode about the Q in a lot of ways.
But I don't think it raises the question so much as it says, you know, listen, we've had a lot of trouble figuring out what the hell the Q really are. So we're going to throw out all of that, you know, their one being thing. We're going to throw out that they're God. We're going to, you know, throw that out a little bit.
They never actually said that the Q were one being.
They implied that, you know.
I don't know that I agree with that. I mean, I think that the Q are whatever they want the Q to be.
And maybe that's as simple as that. Maybe the Q are whatever they want the Q to be to fit the episode. In this episode, they're super beings.
I don't like that. I think the genre fiction needs to play by a set of rules. And I don't like it when they just go, well, we don't need rules.
But Q also had his powers removed. Remember that?
Of course I do.
Well, if Q had his power removed and found a tornado, I don't think he would have done so well at that time.
No, but...
They probably stripped Amanda's parents of their Q powers when they... violated the rule.
And this is the problem with omnipotent beings.
Yeah.
Like if Amanda disliked Q so much and if she was so afraid of Q, why doesn't she just strip Q of his powers?
Well, because she doesn't know how. I'm sure it's like a very
Can do all kinds of things.
There's paperwork involved.
She fixed a planet's atmosphere. I think she can figure out how to strip
all she needed
Q
to do was get a very big wind.
Let's talk about Picard.
Okay, let's talk about Picard. What do you want to talk about Picard? About?
In a way, this is a very self-aware episode. Q says what we all think. He loves Picard's speeches. Every time he comes, he gets one. It's great. That's very self-aware, very meta. It's a very good Picard speech at the end of the episode when he's talking about the Q's morality and
how he
thinks that maybe Q is fascinated by humans because they have a superior moral code and blah, blah, blah. And that could all be true. But I think that what's more interesting about Picard's sort of reactions in this episode is that, A, he's very protective of Amanda. And I think that that goes a long way towards showing that he's not really against the Q. He's against Q, if you know what I mean, because Q was kind of an asshole. But also that at one point Picard says directly to Q, I don't trust you,
which of course
we all know no one should trust Q. But then towards the end of the episode, he says he has no reason to think that Q is lying. He has every reason to think Q is lying. I mean, I don't get that at all. Really, Picard, you don't think that Q could be lying to you? I think that Q could lie to you a lot, and I think Q has lied to you, and I think Q continues to lie to you. So,
well, that's what the Q continuum. He's continuum to lie.
but I mean, seriously, like, that's kind of makes Picard seem like a little bit of an idiot.
You know, something. It's just. I don't know. Everything was. This is very much Amanda's episode, and so everything is revolving around her. And if Picard is a little different, it doesn't really, like, I think to a degree his attitude can shift for the plot. This is an episode that I enjoyed the hell out of while I was watching it, and now as we're talking and picking apart, like, the seams are really showing.
Yeah.
And that's interesting.
It's not a good episode.
No,
but it unravels a lot.
But it was an entertaining episode. Here we go. Yeah.
It is entertaining. I will grant you that. But I think that the episode has a lot of conceptual problems that make it not stand up to any sort of analysis.
I guess I will never rewatch it then.
I mean, this is not an episode that I rewatch, really. You know, I don't watch Q episodes a lot because I frankly don't like Q. There's a later Q episode. He appears again in the sixth season. after not appearing in the fifth season at all, because I guess they figured they needed they're making up for lost time. But it's a very good episode, and it's not really about Q at all, which is good.
Okay.
This is kind of the last Q episode that is kind of about Q,
okay,
in a way, which is good. And I think he only appears twice more. So
I know he's in the finale.
He is in the finale.
And I know that's very much not a Q episode.
It's very much not a Q episode, and that's fine. I don't know. Yeah, it's weird because we haven't really talked about Amanda much, and she is the ostensible sort of protagonist of the episode. But she's kind of a non-entity in it.
Yeah, she's a representative character. She represents she is in a way a generic person who is just torn between two sides. And
also, by the way, I just realized that every single Q we've ever seen is white. So does that imply that the Q are racists?
I think it implies that the casting department is.
Ah.
In many ways, the episode is showing kind of the downsides of both humanity and Q, as well as their advantages.
Okay.
And I think both sides the entire time are basically telling her, like, look, don't join the other side because the disadvantages are too great, you know. Less so on the Federation side, but definitely Q is talking about how shitty it is to be human. And
yeah,
the, you know, if Dr. Crusher and Picard basically say, you know, but this is what you want, you know, this is your goal, you know, don't let this distract you. And, you know, if you become a Q, you're going to have this unrestrained power. I mean, it's implied, especially, you know, that she's going to go a little too far with this. And she begins to when she kidnaps Riker, when she, you know.
Well, I also think that, you know, it's interesting that you say that because, of course, there is kind of a subtle read on the episode, or kind of a subtle point that the episode is making, which is that when you have sort of nearly omnipotent powers, you kind of are more constrained than would be if she just gave them up and lived as a human.
Well, I mean, Q very specifically says, like, you know, well, some of us, they, I mean, you get the sense that Q is very high up in the Q continuum because he keeps getting sent to missions, and yet he doesn't quite step in line with them.
That's funny. I have a different take on that because I've always got the impression that Q gets sent on missions because
he's low level.
He's low level, huh. And also because he has sort of some experience with humans.
I mean, it's probably a bunch of, again, we don't quite know what the Q are, but
Q is basically the intern who people give Photoshop assignments to because he's 20 years old.
Oh my God. And she's an intern too.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Oh, the Q feel that they do need a moral and ethical restraints on their behavior because, again, if you do have a group of omnipotent beings running around,
the Q think that?
Q says that the Q implies that the Q think that, yeah.
Okay, all right.
He says at one point, you know, well, when they talk about, like, oh, we had them executed, he says, like, well, there's a few people with a bunch of, you know, responsibility, and they think that, like, and he's saying this, you know, making fun of them, saying that, you know, implying that he thinks it's a stuffy and an old-fashioned rule, but
well, I guess that's true because I think that the implication with Q has always been that he's sort of outside of what the Q continuum thinks is appropriate behavior. Yeah, yeah. Okay, fine.
And so, you know, while I think Q skirts the line, and I mean, again, he had his powers stripped. We've seen the Q disciplining their own before.
Sure.
And so, you know, again, that I think if they can strip powers from someone, I think they can execute one of their own.
Okay.
I think they can do that.
Okay. That's fair.
And again, the episode only works if that happens. So obviously, you know.
And again, we tried talking about Amanda and we talked about the Q again. That's the thing. I don't really think there's much to talk
about.
But
again,
with her.
She's competing philosophies, and she's good at everything, and she's young and pretty, and she's, you know, cute. That's it.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, in a sense, she's kind of the child of two divorcing parents.
Yeah.
And she's kind of caught in the middle.
Yeah. And I think the fact that she...
And I think the end of the episode is her making a decision that she's going to emphatically go one way or the other.
Yeah, I think the end of the episode implies that she's going to be full Q, but with the additional morality of humanity.
I was about to say, I think that she's going to be a different Q.
Yeah, the Q that we see, John DeLancey, spends his Q time grinching the Who's. That's what he does. Like, he just, you know, plays tricks. If he has an assignment, he's going to do it in the most grudging and obnoxious way he can possible. Otherwise, he's just dicking around the galaxy seeing what he can see. I mean, the part when you know, Crusher says, oh, well, if I had, you know, power, I would use it to heal people. And then she only reluctantly admits, you know, she's not sure if she would see her husband. I mean, for Crusher, there is no contest that it would be a good to be healing the sick with your Q powers. And that's, I think, what Amanda has, you know, ends up taking away from that, that frankly, with great power comes great responsibility. And that, let's face it, she wants to be a doctor. That is what she wants to do with her life.
Sure.
She wants to use her in, you know, at the beginning, she's using her intelligence and her skills and her gifts to help people to heal, to learn how to do a better job of that. Here she's been given so many more powers to do that she's going to naturally use that, not for herself, because I think the scene with Riker makes it clear to her that it's not going to be satisfying.
Right.
You know, frankly, Q just never had a bad experience, you know, that way. He never had that realization. He never needed to.
Yeah.
He never had the context to. And so I guess the Star Trek, I think, believes the ideal is humanity plus, in a way, rather than, you know, humanity, that humanity can get better, and that the ideal is to stay human, but at the height of your abilities, in a way. And I think Amanda is kind of the expression of that in this episode. And I guess I liked that because I felt that it was a very satisfying ending as far as her decision and where she took it at the end.
Yeah, and I also think that – I don't think that the show has any doubts that human morality and sort of the way that humans are operating in the galaxy is superior to the way that the Q are in the galaxy, perhaps.
Well, again, the Q versus Q, we can only say what we've seen about Q's morality, which is that he's amoral in the sense that he doesn't really give a shit. He's a spirit of chaos.
So
it's implied that the Q might have a greater degree of morality. I mean, frankly, I think if Picard sat down with the people who decided that, you know, Q needs to go and investigate Amanda, I think he would come off with a different impression.
That could be, you know, and I think that in a sense, what this episode and what this conversation is making clear to me is that Q is really the Andy Kaufman of the Q continuum.
And let's face it, Q does end up doing the right thing most of the time at the end. He eventually fixes or helps fix his mess or figures it out, you know. And I don't know. You say he has experience with humans, but maybe the reason the Q keeps sending him to Picard and company is because, like, no, you know, they're good for you. They're better friends for you to hang out with, you know.
Yeah.
You'll learn something from that, Picard.
And maybe that's why Q was fascinated by them, in a sense.
He knows that they – because if even at the end of the day, if he knows what the right thing to do is in any situation, and he sees that, God damn it, Picard does it in every situation, and God damn it, Picard is kind of cool. And,
yeah.
You know, that's, I think, where he's at with it.
Yeah, I think so. I will give this episode 12 puppies.
Aww!
Which is really 5 puppies.
I would give it 7 puppies, which is really 7 puppies.
That's nice. All right, well, as always, if you'd like to share your thoughts on this episode or share your thoughts about the 2 episodes we talked about, just go to the post on the show, trekaboutshow.com. Follow us on Twitter for all our updates, which is trekaboutshow. Go to facebook.com/trekaboutshow. And also, the most important thing, leave us a review on iTunes.
I have nothing to add to this other than do that.
Next week, we are talking about Rascals and A Fistful of Datas.
Ew.
We'll see you then.